The Public Safety Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. We don't quite have a quorum yet, so we need approval of the minutes. We'll wait on that. So we left off with the presentation of the Department of Corrections. They were almost done, and then we'll move into the Department of Public Safety. I think I'll wait to announce the tour information survey until we have a few more members here. So, Commissioner, are you ready to proceed?
We are ready, and thank you for the invite back.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm going to respond to a couple questions that were asked yesterday, and that was the percentage of offenders that complete treatment, either chemical dependency or sex offender treatment, as a percentage of need, and only 34% of those people identified with a chemical dependency problem are being treated, and only 20% of our sex offenders who should be getting treatment are getting treatment. I also need to correct a percentage. You asked Director Gerlicher about the amount of federal funds that would be withheld if we did not comply with PREA. And she answered 30%. Actually, it's 5%, which is a $250,000 penalty. You also asked some other questions about...
Can you say that one again? I just sort of lost that one. So that's
the PREA compliance.
That's the rape elimination proof.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. How much would we lose?
$250,000 if we did not comply. But I'm very confident, Mr. Chair, that we will be in full compliance.
And Commissioner, at some point when we start talking about institutions, can we get into that in a little more detail, as if it's been a successful program? And
Mr. Chair, yes, we have some good statistics already about levels of incidents, and actually every month that the wardens meet, that is one of the first reported statistics, our PREA incidents, we call them.
Okay.
Very cognizant of the time, and Mr. Chair, and we will do our best to not affect the time of the Public Safety Commissioner's presentation. Okay. Seated to my left.
We have one. Was it on this, Rep. Seminole, Mullery? Well,
Mr. Chairman, I apologize if I missed it yesterday, but it's almost exact. It's what percentage of those that need mental health get it? It's a real quick question.
Can you answer that, Commissioner? Or do you want to wait?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, if in fact we consider chemical dependency a mental illness beyond, or are you looking for more clinical type of mental illness diagnosis?
Representative Mullery.
Chairman, I don't want to hold it up now. I can...
No, ask the question, because then they can bring the information later. So what would you like them to provide?
I'd like to know specifically just on mental health issues.
I cannot answer that today, but we will certainly respond to you.
Very good. I need now, before we get on the presentation, I need a motion to approve the minutes of Wednesday, January 16th. Representative Kelly moves. All those in favor, any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Proceed, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Seated to my left is Ron Solheid, deputy of our Community Services Division, which is more easily understood as probation and parole. And all of our field services throughout the state are under his wing. And we will discuss as rapidly as we can some programs and initiatives in that division. I think for time efficiency, Mr. Chair, could I ask maybe that we just fly through this presentation and maybe save questions for the end?
You know, actually, I'd like to just, you know, it's fine. I think we have the time. I'd rather that you spend the time and members get an opportunity to understand what you're doing, and we have, we'll DPS if we can't fit it all today. Commissioner, you can come back. Okay, great. Okay, so take your time.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as Commissioner Roy said, we're here to talk about kind of the high-level trends, and one of the areas we're looking at is improvements in efficiencies, and really this extends within our entire agency, not just community services or field services. So with that, couple of improvements and efficiencies that I want to speak about today are two areas in particular. One is our transition from prison to community effort. What that is, it was brought into play or launched by the National Institute of Corrections back in 2001 as they recognized that there were a high number of offenders returning to prison, whether it be through recidivism and or restructures for violations of their conditions of probation. Our agency has been involved in these efforts through a number of initial pilot projects that were started at our agency, included our MCORP initiative, our Minnesota Comprehensive Offender Reentry Program, and our Prison Reentry Initiative, or PRI, which kind of positioned us pretty well to begin the process of implementing TPC throughout our agency. I'd like to play just a little brief video clip to provide some information, then I'll follow up.
We're fortunate in Minnesota because many of the staff that we have here understand that their role is to help offenders get out and stay out of prison. Really what it is, it's bumping it up a notch and taking it to the next level, giving them additional tools that they can use to motivate the offenders to make the necessary changes so when they do get released, they're released and successful and they stay in the community.
It's all about public safety. That's our ultimate. Help the client change his behavior, change his thought process. Long term, we're going to use this more so just worry about the issue.
I want to say that 90% of these guys in here are going to be out someday. I don't want to see them come back in again. Some of these guys have gone for 20 years, and with the interactions that I've had with these guys, I want to see them do well. I want to see them go out and take care of their families. I want to see them pay taxes. I want to see them live life.
That's just a very brief snippet of what TPC is and how we're looking at implementing. But as you can see, it's our facilities and our community services or field services staff that are moving ahead with this effort. TPC is really a nationwide effort to define where transition and reentry efforts need to arrive at to be successful. And as I said earlier, we've been going down this path and positioning our agency in this area for some time. And as we stated yesterday, about 95% of all offenders are going to be returning to the community, and we want to be sure we're doing everything we can to ensure that they're successful in not returning to prison. In 2009, our agency received a technical assistance grant from the National Institute of Corrections to really help us move this process along, and we put together a steering committee that has been working to develop this plan for implementation that we're moving down the path with. And we are positioned now to really start this effort in March of this year within our prisons. Our field services, community services unit has been engaged in a lot of training around evidence-based practices, programs, services, linkages in the community for a number of years, and now we're looking at our prisons also becoming more engaged in this, and it's more of a philosophy shift. You know, when we mentioned yesterday, we have about 2,300 uniformed staff, we have support staff, we have a variety of staff within the prison system that have really focused on security, accountability, and safety within our institutions, but to some extent they're kind of an untapped resource when we get into looking at how we promote change in offenders. And so we're looking at providing training to our staff within the institutions to help them assist us in promoting change within the offenders and providing some opportunities for how we dialogue, how we communicate with offenders, and how we can promote this offender change as they go into prison and come out of prison hopefully better than when they entered. Some of the major components of TPC include collaborative leadership teams, essentially state and local partnerships with providing things that offenders need, such as housing, employment, mental health, medical services as they are transitioning out. and we are developing those collaborative teams at this time. Rational and comprehensive planning process, which is what our TPC steering committee has been engaged in over the last couple of years. Implementation of validated risk offender risk assessments. We've been utilizing offender risk assessments for a number of years. We're just moving to what is known as the LSCMI for risk assessments for our offenders in the prisons. We're trying to target those that are at the highest risk of reoffending for our services and our programs. Implementation of evidence, effective research-based interventions. I think Dr. Grant Dewey did a good job talking about all of the research that we're doing. We want to ensure that the programs and services that we're providing for our offenders within the institutions and the linkages that we're providing in the community are effective. And the only way we can do that is to ensure that we're tapping into the research that's out there and the research that we're doing to ensure that we are getting the most for our dollars that are spent in programs and services. Another major component is ensuring that all transitioning offenders have basic resources. As I stated earlier, housing, employment, simple things like identification, offenders coming out of prison, making sure that they have birth certificates, social security cards, state IDs, so that they can gain employment and housing when they come back out into the community. We've done a lot of work in that area with our transition coordinators and at our prisons, and I believe on Tuesday we're going to give you more information, more of an overview on all of our transition services. So the big area that we're looking at now that was referenced here in the video clip was expanding the traditional roles of our correctional staff beyond security and utilizing that resource of over 2,000 corrections officers to help us promote change in the offenders, and it's going to require a training effort on our part, and we're just engaging in that at the present time. So that, in a nutshell, is TPC and where we're at and where we're headed with that major initiative.
Deputy Commissioner, we can spend some time on this Tuesday also, but so how are, I mean, is MnChoice, is that new?
MnChoice is new. We just rolled that out. That's the next initiative I want to talk about.
Oh, okay.
Has to do with our victims. In fact, I believe you should have gotten a handout or a brochure.
Okay.
I think it was being handed out.
Okay. Before you do MnChoice, I just like how are you measuring success of the reentry programs of MCOR, and how are you measuring success?
Well, as Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as Dr. Dewey noted yesterday, we're doing a fair amount of research around any programs that we implement. And obviously one measure of success is our recidivism rates. We're looking at currently now we have some Second Chance Act grant funds, and we're doing an evaluability assessment right now of how we're utilizing those funds to target offenders who have come back on a revocation to prison. So we're looking at that at the present time. We constantly, you know, review these programs to ensure that they are evidence-based and that there is an impact.
When on Tuesday, this is a, if you could maybe provide this to our committee, it's on your website. It's the adult inmate profile. It's under statistics on your website.
Okay.
I think this is a good document. But if you could expand it, and Mr. Walsh, if you could maybe help with trying to, so we can look over maybe a 10-year period at these measurements, because it's hard. I mean, it all sounds good, and it sounded good 2 years ago when I was here, but until we look at those recidivism rates and why offenders are going back, it's hard for, I think, legislators to evaluate spending more resources on reentry programs, which I think are good, but we need to know that they're successful, and if they're not, what else can be done? And then there's also some nonprofit reentry groups that are you're contracting with or working with, and we need to know whether they're effective also. So maybe that could be part of your Tuesday presentation.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, sorry to interrupt, but
Representative Kelly,
if you get us that information, could I get mine in English? We seem to have a few pamphlets in Spanish, so.
Necesitamos in English, por favor.
We were just testing you, Mr. Chair. I didn't realize they gave us the Spanish version as well. We will make sure and have adequate other pamphlets available. That's just to demonstrate that we do have these available for the victims' community in
multiple languages. Es muy importante en dos inglés y en español.
Better man than me.
Sí.
Please proceed.
The Min Choice, just very quickly, Min Choice, in fact, our Victim Services Unit and Restorative Justice Unit at the Department of Corrections is really a collaborative with public safety in how we provide services and information to victims. Min Choice is an online web-based system that was implemented within the last year to provide for notification and information on offenders sentenced to our DOC facilities. A couple of important points to point out with Min Choice is it is a website that allows 24/7 access to victims and their families. It allows them to create an account and to choose the type of notification that is best for them. In the past, all of our victim notification was essentially hard copy files, letters that went out. Victims had and their families had to go through a process of requesting this information, and it was sent out through the U.S. mail. Here they have instant access day or night to this system and to the information that is contained there. The website provides them with the victims with the OID number, offender photos, if appropriate, custody and supervision status, and release information on offenders that is up to date, so they know when offenders are coming out or if they've changed locations within our system. It also allows the victims to provide information to case managers and agents that may be considered when offenders are re-entering the community, so it gives them a voice. It's important that we hear from victims and their families with how we're managing and supervising offenders and what their concerns or issues are. So we want to be sure we continue to do that, and this new initiative has allowed much greater access than ever before. The website provides information and links also on community resources to victims and their families, and it also provides for automated updates. So we can update them with new resources as they become available, which we were not able to do in the past. So I think this is, again, one of our more efficient, cost-effective, and user-friendly initiatives that has recently been implemented.
Very good. Any questions? Representative Schoen, sorry.
Mr. Chair, that's plenty fine.
You're not all sitting at the same place as you were before.
I'm trying to juggle it up a little bit.
I was looking over.
I'm sitting by the other team today. My question maybe was to you, Mr. Chair, on what the question you asked and to you, sir, related to some of the statistics related to reintegration on programs. Yesterday we heard some numbers related to percentages of success, like with chemical dependency. The information I'm curious about is percentage of participation of the entire population, because you gave great success rates, but if only 10% of the population is participating, then how great is it? So those are the types of things that I'm curious about as well, and maybe that's what you're leading to.
Exactly. I think we just need more of that as when we start digging deeper into your budget.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. We'll bring more of that information on Tuesday with our reentry and our success rates there.
Okay, and I believe we're also having a day on sort of treatment, aren't we? So we can get into that in more detail also. Or similar.
Mr. Chair, it would be too long for your committee probably, but maybe it would be possible, like when they're talking about visits, Mr. Dewey has about an hour presentation roughly that I've been to it over at DOC on their results on different effects of things. So it might be good to see if they could set up something for those members that wanted to sometime.
We will look at that. Thank you. Commissioner, anything else?
Mr. Chair, in that regard, you saw the list that of our research yesterday, each of those items could be an hour presentation, and Dr. Dewey does do a great overview of them, and he can get through it fairly rapidly, but I think a two-hour minimum would be almost necessary. But there are meeting exactly the questions that are being asked here, and I think would be very valuable in the future.
Okay, very good. Anything else?
Sure.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, to my left is Terry Carlson. She is the Deputy Commissioner, basically in charge of our institutions.
Welcome.
She has a long history of working in institutions as a line staff, corrections officer, and as a warden. And we will be efficient in our time here as well.
Welcome to the committee.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm happy to be here today, and we're going to get into a lot more detail of facilities and upcoming hearings. But what I want to do today is just walk you through several different programs, improvements, and efficiencies that we've been making within the Facilities Division. Before I start talking about the crisis intervention team training specifically, I want to tell you a little story. Back in October, one of our correctional officers from our Stillwater facility was providing security coverage at the St. Joseph's Hospital, where we have some of our inmates who need hospitalization housed, and they provide the security for them. That day, he was walking in a hallway, and a staff from St. Joe's came to him and said, "We need your help. We need your help right now. We've got an emergency situation." And he went with the staff and found that there was a nurse's aide who was being held hostage by another patient at St. Joe's, not one of our correctional clients, but a patient at St. Joe's. And he was in his room holding this nursing assistant with scissors to their neck. And our officer, Shane Warnke, entered the room very cautiously, got some information, and then used the skills that he learned from our crisis intervention team training to successfully de-escalate that situation and have the patient put down the scissors and release the nursing assistant who was being held. He saved that person's life. I really believe that he saved that person's life that day. And he accredits it to the training that he received through our agency for de-escalation through crisis intervention training. So that's what I want to talk to you a little bit about today. It's a training that's based on the Memphis Crisis Intervention Team model, which promotes the use of verbal de-escalation skills before using force when dealing with an offender who may be having a mental health crisis. It's a system, CIT, is used throughout the nation and within our state by many law enforcement agencies. And it's for us, it's a collaboration between our line staff, our behavioral health staff, and also NAMI Minnesota. And NAMI is the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and we work very, very closely with their staff on this initiative. The National Institute of Corrections, which is a federal organization, sponsors training that staff from four of our facilities have attended to learn about the crisis intervention team model. We're one of the first State Department of Corrections to implement CIT in our facilities, and so far 108 staff have been trained. Our goal is to have 25% of our corrections officers trained, and right now we're offering four training sessions per year. They're each 5 days long, so it's pretty intensive. Field agents will also be receiving this training, and we've also had people from Hennepin County and other local law enforcement come and participate in our training sessions. And we've also attended training at other law enforcement CIT training sessions. So now I'm going to show you a video clip. It's about 3 minutes long that will talk about CIT. And I need to make a little disclaimer at the beginning that there's some yelling and a few swear words at the beginning. So let's see. We can find. There it is. So just know that it's a training scenario for us. I had it.
Did you?
Yeah.
200 have two unruly hostile offenders.
We don't care why they're acting out. We got a job to do. So let's get a cell entry. Let's mace them. We'll go in. We'll get them. We'll put them on the restraint board, that type of thing.
Face down on the back. Face down.
Well, it's okay. I didn't realize that was going to happen. I was trying to just get the sound up a little bit.
I don't know what happened.
Probably screwed up the whole tape.
I've progressed in my career.
It's okay.
I've gotten older and been here for a while. We started trying to talk these offenders out of the states that they're in. And sometimes it's effective, sometimes it's not. So when the CIT program came around, we were already using it, but we just didn't have a label for it.
Officer Mark Craig is part of a new effort by the Minnesota Department of Corrections to enhance safety for staff and offenders.
How are you doing, Sam?
Crisis intervention training gives staff the tools they need to engage offenders at moments of high crisis, de-escalating the situation before more aggressive methods are necessary.
They said they was going to watch out for me, huh? They said they was going to fucking visit.
In classroom settings like this one, DOC staff engage in realistic scenarios with specially trained actors. Officers who learn these techniques and employ them in their jobs can then become instructors themselves.
The actors are trained. They're trying to elicit a specific response from them.
There's no time to waste.
They reward you when you're moving in the right direction. They sting you when you're not. So they more or less control the direction that the scenario goes. And then we will take the time and pause and give them feedback and maybe guide them if they're on the wrong track.
Officers who complete this training use it on the job every day. They'll tell you it takes extra time to listen to offenders, but it's time well spent.
There's potential for injury to myself. There's potential injury to the other officers. There's potential injury for the offenders. And at my age, you know, the wrestling stuff kind of slows down a little bit, and there's a little bit more patience involved. And
most of the time, I don't want to spend 8 hours smelling like urine chemicals, and the offender doesn't want it. I don't want to risk that chance for staff to be hurt, receive injuries, or the offender to receive injuries. So it's a better off for all of us.
While this program draws heavily on the experience of corrections employees, it also brings in expertise from the community. An ongoing partnership between the DOC and the National Alliance on Mental Illness brings advocates and experts to the table.
Another piece of CIT is those partnerships continue after the training takes place. So if the agency policy needs to be revisited to support officers who are using CIT skills, we all get together and talk about how can we do this.
You know, we're trained to react. When something happens, we're trained to take action right away. This is teaching people to, hey, take a step back and look at the whole picture and see what's going on before you react. And if it, you know, prevents somebody from getting hurt, you know, whether it's the offender or us, it's well worth the effort.
So that's the crisis intervention team training, and really is a safety initiative for us in our agency. The next improvement that I want to talk to you about is offender restitution collection. Certainly within our agency.
Can you just hold on 1 second? We have one question. Representative Slocum.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. One of the previous slides talked about felony level assaults on staff, and clearly it's the number is down, but you have a generic kind of number. What percentage of staff suffers not felony level assaults, but inclusive of felony level assaults, but an injury relating to their job?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I don't have specific numbers of staff who have received injuries from assaults from offender behavior off the top of my head, but that certainly is something that I can provide to you.
I'd be very interested in that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Please proceed.
Okay, with the offender restitution collection, Certainly we value holding offenders accountable and also restoring justice for victims. And so in April, we are going to implement a new restitution collection procedure in our prisons. 63% of all our incarcerated offenders owe court-ordered restitution and fines, and that equates to approximately $36 million in fines and restitution. The average court-ordered restitution amount per person is, however, about $800. So the changes that we're going to implement in April are intended to, like I said before, restore justice for victims by identifying methods to increase the amount of restitution paid by the offenders. And the changes will enhance that offender's ability to pay their court-ordered fines and obligations restitution over a shorter period of time. And many, many of our offenders will fulfill their obligations before they're released to prison, so they won't have that burden when they are out in the community trying to get a new job, and they'll have that taken care of. So we're excited to start this new process. All right, the third issue I'm going to talk about is a new program, a new training program that we've started in our corrections facilities that's called Corrections Fatigue to Fulfillment. And certainly we know that corrections staff work in an environment where there's chronic stress and continual alertness is needed, and there's an ever-present possibility of violence. Staff are exposed to violence in a multitude of ways. There's offenders' fights, there's self-injurious behavior that offenders participate in, there's offender manipulation and setups, there's offender assaults on staff, and there's group violence. What we know also is that long-term exposure to this kind of climate can breed a lot of stress and distress for staff who work in our facilities. This class, which is titled Corrections Fatigue to Fulfillment, helps staff realize and acknowledge the ongoing impact of working in this environment and provides them effective, practical tools for managing stress and helps us identify organizational strategies to deal with this stress that happens in our facilities on an ongoing basis, and hopefully will increase job satisfaction for our employees as well. We anticipate this class will have a positive impact on employee sick leave use and improve the overall employee wellness. The class is currently being offered to our corrections staff and has been very well received. And in fact, between the crisis intervention team training class that we provide now and this corrections fatigue to fulfillment, I've received numerous comments from staff, emails, phone calls, and visits saying these are two of the best training scenarios, sessions that we've ever attended in our careers. And so we really think that we're on the right track with this. And certainly I hope this shows that, you know, we really value our employees and want them to be well and healthy. The next initiative that I'm going to talk to you about is our offender OMAIL process. And that is a process where offenders can receive emails from their family members. We started this back in November of 11 with a pilot project at two of our correctional facilities and rolled it out in the spring of this past year to all of our facilities. As reported in Dr. Grant Dewey's research on prison visitation, strengthening and reestablishing family ties helps offenders improve the likelihood for successful reentry in our communities and thereby reduces the likelihood for them to return or recidivate. Please rest assured, inmates don't have access to the internet. Right now, the process is only one direction. Family members can send emails to it's a company that we work with, a vendor that we work with, and we have a computer in our mailroom that receives these emails and then prints them and gets them to the inmates in their housing units. But even with that process, it's faster to get an email than it is to get a letter in the mail. And, you know, with today's propensity to use email, it really is helpful for family members. Currently, we get about 6,000 emails a month in our facilities, and that rate has been increasing on a monthly basis.
Chair? Representative Cornish has a question.
Mr. Chair, yesterday we heard an estimate, I think only a certain small percentage or something of the phone conversations could actually be tracked. What's the percentage on these emails, and how many staff does it take to check out that many emails a month?
Deputy Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish, thanks for that great question. Because I forgot to mention how the OMAIL system really helps improve our security and safety within our facilities. The system is set up so that it can identify keywords, and we can set up what those keywords are. So if it's drugs, you know, fight, assault, injury, those kinds of things, they're tagged by the vendor that we work with, and our Office of Special Investigations reviews emails before they're released to our mailroom staff to print them and send them on to the offenders in the housing units. So we really see that piece of it as a great improvement for us. Also, we have an ongoing record of those emails that are coming in. And then also, occasionally in the mail we get letters that have stamps that are soaked with drugs or contraband that's hidden within the folds of a greeting card. And with OMAIL, you don't have to worry about that at all. So it really creates a safer environment for our staff. Thank you.
Do you want to finish up, Deputy Commissioner?
Yep. I have one more slide. I want to talk a little bit about green initiatives.
One more question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Representative Schoen.
I'll let her finish the next slide, but I'll have some questions after.
Okay. We're going to have to, we've got DPS coming up here too, so why don't we just say that at the quarter two for sure we'll be done with the DOC for today. Okay?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Within the Facilities Division, we're always looking for ways to mitigate the increasing costs of energy. Zoned heating, lighting, window replacements, those kinds of things. As you know, we have 10 correctional facilities, many of which are old and in constant need for repairs. Our Red Wing facility and our St. Cloud facilities were constructed in 1889, and our Stillwater facility was built in 1914. So there's always lots of asset preservation needs at those facilities. The money that we receive from the legislature is used for all those things, and we look for ways to find energy savings as well. In fact, as we disperse the last amount of asset preservation money to our facilities, a total of one-third of that money went specifically to energy savings projects, including thermostat controls, replacement of hot water heaters and with energy efficient models, upgrades to boiler controls and pumps, and a lot of door and window replacement. We're also improving our recycling efforts and have started a worm composting process at our Stillwater facility. That's a picture of some of the worms. We use food waste and then use... There's no video. Yeah, and we give them food waste. They process that, and then we use the byproduct fertilizer on our gardens and for lawn maintenance. Additionally, we've started to recycle milk cartons. We have a pilot project at our St. Cloud facility. We did find a vendor who is willing to pay us for our milk cartons once we've cleaned and palletized them. So we're excited to roll that out to all of the facilities as well. And finally, we've received some technical assistance from the National Institute of Corrections to add energy efficiency components to our vocational education curriculum so that offenders will be learning these skills as well in the cabinet making classes, printing, metalworking, and those kinds of things. And that concludes my part of the presentation.
Very good. Thank you. We have questions from Representative Schoen.
Mr. Chair, and this, and you can correct me if I'm asking these in the wrong place, but these are questions I'd like to see, or information I'd like to see, is like staffing levels over the last 10 years. I'd like to piggyback on Representative Slocum. When you talk about injuries, I want to hear about injuries as a whole, and you know work comp as far as not just felony assaults and maybe what she's getting at, just work related injuries. I don't want to hear about just only actions with just a violent inmate. And just I want to make sure that we're staffing well. And then the ratios. I know that you have a staffing ratio. Are they covered? I mean, obviously, in this is in relation to the staffing levels. Are we covering this with overtime, or do we have enough staff at the prison to cover these ratios as well? And that's just information I'd like to hear. You don't have to answer that today. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you. We'll answer those questions later.
Very good. Thank you. Okay, Commissioner, any closing comments?
The only thank you for your attention to our department so early, and we are always focused on mission, and we are in the belief that we are meeting the mission in some areas, and we also recognize that we have deficits in other areas. And I really thank this committee for its sharp questions, and we look forward to a return here. And I'd like to thank the Commissioner of Public Safety for waiting for our presentation to complete. We have a good working collaborative, and we're very pleased with that relationship.
Very good. Thanks. Thank you very much for your overview, and we'll get into this in much more depth. Thank you all. Commissioner Dolma? Commissioner, welcome to the committee. Sorry for taking some of your time here, but we want to give all the departments as much time as needed, and we'll have you back several more times during the budget process. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and certainly we understand how this works, and you need the time that you need to have your questions answered, so we'll be happy to come back if necessary, and we'll be having ongoing discussions, as you indicate. I would just like to start out by saying thanks very much to you, Mr. Chair, and committee members for taking the time to learn more about the Department of Public Safety. Many of you at the table know a lot about the Department of Public Safety, and some are very new, and so we hope to give you sort of an overview of our operations, and we'll certainly answer specific questions as they might come in. By way of introduction, I would just like to introduce myself. I'm Mona Doman. And it is really a great honor and a privilege to serve as the Commissioner of Public Safety and to work with all of you in the area of and interest of public safety around our entire state. We know that this is the beginning, like I said, of many discussions we'll be having during the current session and beyond. I just briefly would like to give you a little bit of history about me. I came to the state in 2011 after having served 29 years in law enforcement. The most recent 27 years I was at the Maple Grove Police Department, and the last 10 of those years I served as a police chief in Maple Grove. Prior to moving to Maple Grove and being employed by the police department there, I also served with the City of Glencoe Police Department and the City of Marshall Police Department. And I mention that because I think my experience in Greater Minnesota and having grown up in Greater Minnesota is a constant reminder to me that the work that we do at the Department of Public Safety really has to be impactful to the entire state and not just sort of the metropolitan area where we tend to do most of our work from. So I keep that in mind, and we talk with staff constantly about our relationships around the state of Minnesota. So I have come to state government after almost 30 years of looking from the outside in and from being a consumer of what the state, and because of my history in particular, the Department of Public Safety has offered. I have also always been impressed with the work being done by DPS, and I continue to be impressed and very proud to be a part of this agency. I believe, and I trust that you do too, that our work is at the core of government, and that is to do all that we can to keep the people of Minnesota safe. That work is not always easy. It can be very painful, it can be challenging, and it can be very difficult, as you all well know. But it can also be extremely rewarding if we keep focus and never lose sight of the fact that we have committed ourselves to serving others across the state. Representative Paymar, members, our intent today is to fulfill your request by giving you the following. We'd like to give you a brief history of our agency and each of the jurisdictions under the umbrella of this committee. We'd like to give you an idea of what might be trends or emerging issues that we are facing today and into the future. a snapshot of challenges and successes and what we've done to give better government to the people of Minnesota, and then perhaps to talk about where we might be in the future, 5, 10, and 15 years from now, and then certainly to answer any specific questions that you might have or materials that you might need. I have just a few more opening remarks. We have a short video presentation that really very quickly gives a good overview of our agency, and then I'm going to turn it over to our division directors to talk specifically about their divisions. There's no swearing in our video, I have to say. The Department of Public Safety was initially created in 1969 to act as an administrative agency for several entities located throughout state government. It is Minnesota State Statute 299A, that establishes and organizes the Department of Public Safety. The Office of the Commissioner currently has 7 full-time staff working at the 445 Minnesota Street location, which is commonly referred to as the Bremer Bank Building. You can see it from the freeway, at 7th and Cedar. The positions include myself, Deputy Commissioner Mary Ellison, who many of you know, she's sitting behind me. Our Assistant Commissioner Mark Danaski, former Colonel of the Minnesota State Patrol. Our Legal Counsel, our Legislative and Government Affairs Director, an Executive Aide, and 1 Office Support Staff position. There are also 14 full-time Division Directors reporting to the Commissioners of Public Safety. Additionally, and most importantly, we work with roughly 2,000 extremely dedicated and committed employees making up the DPS employee. On a daily basis, they touch hundreds of Minnesotans, and I continue to be very proud of the work our people do. I truly wish, and we'd invite you to come and visit any of our divisions at any time that you might like. But I wish you could know them all and you could see their work firsthand, because it's really remarkable what is done around this state. We have outlined the following as our mission. This agency, the Department of Public Safety, serves as the backbone for supporting public safety efforts throughout the state of Minnesota. Through the provision of enforcement, service, funding, training, and education, as well as legislative and policy development, we strengthen the overall public safety infrastructure in Minnesota. So within that backbone are the people I've just mentioned, the employees, those providing service to all Minnesotans. And I have laid out 3 basic foundational expectations for every employee, and they are that we work hard. It is our responsibility to be responsive. Minnesotans deserve our best every single day that we come to work. Honesty, to always act with integrity and transparency, and I believe there is no compromise. And then, very simple, to be nice. We need to practice the golden rule internally and externally and always provide outstanding customer service to the people of the state. Currently, we have 6 divisions in the Department of Public Safety that fall under the umbrella of this committee. They are the Emergency Communications Networks Division under the leadership of Jackie Mines, the State Fire Marshal Division under the leadership of the State Fire Marshal, Jerry Rosendahl, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, led by Superintendent Wade Sutter, former police chief in the city of Brooklyn Park. The Alcohol and Gambling Division, being led by Michelle Tuckner, a former Lieutenant Colonel with the Minnesota State Patrol. Our Office of Justice Programs, led by long-term state employee Jerry Beauvair. Our Homeland Security and Emergency Management Division, under the direction of Chris Idy, and filling in for her today, or whenever we might get to that division, is Joe Kelly. For our 2012 specifically accomplishments, there are many, and our work continues as we strive to provide better government in the area of public safety for all people. But I'd like to touch on just 6 accomplishments, 1 from each division, and then you'll hear more from each of our directors. In the Emergency Communications Network, the progress made in the migration of emergency dispatch services to Next Generation 911, or the completion of the construction and rollout of the communication system for emergency responders, or what some of you may know as ARMOR. Or in the State Fire Marshal's Office, where they held their first annual State Fire Marshal's Conference, which provided state and local fire officials and private sector stakeholders with advanced training in their area of expertise. at the BCA, where we have looked at efficiencies as we are in all of our divisions within our agency, and we've streamlined the DWI processing through e-charging, and where they've developed robotics and new DNA technologies to solve more crimes in our state. And in our alcohol and gambling division, where they have partnered with Minute Services, formerly known as OET, or Office of Enterprise Technology, to transition to e-licensing. This is resulting in reduced processing time for approval processes they are involved in, such as alcohol brand label registration or off-sale liquor license approvals. The Office of Justice Programs continues to administer state and federal grant funds to state, local, not-for-profit, and tribal agencies who provide crime victim services, law enforcement activities, and juvenile justice programming. And finally, in the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, where they secured federal disaster relief totaling nearly $52 million for communities affected by four events involving flooding or tornadoes, of which you all are familiar with. So in just a few minutes, you'll hear from the division directors individually, but before I turn it over to them, we'd like to play just this short video for you. So you know, this video is a video that we show to every new employee that comes into our agency, and we know you're not our new employees, but it gives a really good sort of 50,000 foot view of the agency, and it'll help you understand, and it shows you just a snippet of some of the divisions that you won't necessarily hear about in this committee. Thank you.
This is a very diverse and complex agency, and the work that you do will significantly impact the people of the state of Minnesota on a daily basis. As you work to fulfill your responsibilities, I ask three things of you. Number one, put your best foot forward every day. Work hard. Number two, be honest and transparent in all of your interactions. And number three, practice the golden rule. Treat other people as you would want to be treated. As you do your work, I trust that if you keep these guiding principles in mind, you will find that your time here at the state of Minnesota will be rewarding and fulfilling. On behalf of Governor Mark Dayton, the people of the state of Minnesota, and all of us here at the Department of Public Safety, congratulations and welcome. The really interesting thing is everyone is very passionate about what they do.
It's DPS. Has excellent employees, hardworking, professional, and they operate with integrity.
They are the most passionate, dedicated, brilliant, helpful public employees in the state. I would put them up against anybody.
This is really a wonderful agency, and you're going to have a lot of fun.
We have a tremendous amount of pride in what we do. Unlike a lot of other agencies that have a single mission, we have a lot of different things going on.
DPS is an entire team.
Primarily, we oversee alcohol and gambling, which are two of the largest industries in the state of Minnesota. They're multi-billion-dollar agencies, so we provide regulatory authority over those, and we also take some enforcement action when necessary over those divisions.
There are four divisions within the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. We have the Investigative Division, which is our police officers, our sworn police officers that are special agents, and they work out in the community throughout 10 field offices in the state. Then we have our crime lab, which is our laboratory section, provides all the forensic science services in Minnesota. And then, of course, we have our Minnesota Justice Information Systems, which is all the criminal history and fingerprint information for all criminal justice throughout Minnesota. And last, and certainly not least, is our administrative services and training section, which they actually deliver training to law enforcement professionals throughout the state. We really serve as a safety net to our local partners.
The commissioner's office are commonly referred to as the 10th floor by a lot of people. Sometimes you'll hear longtime employees talking about the 10th floor and they don't even really know kind of what goes on up here. But really the commissioner's office for the Department of Public Safety provides the oversight to all the employees of the commissioner's office, to the rest of the agencies that we support across the state of Minnesota, as well as to the executive branch, the governor's office and chief of staff, and concerning the issues that take place in the department.
We are here to, again, do whatever we can to make sure that we have the resources to serve the citizens and improve public safety in the state of Minnesota.
The Office of Communications helps to tell the DPS story, and we work with all the divisions throughout the agency on that mission. And we use traditional media, social media, even some paid advertising to help get the word out. You find that during your time with DPS, we may come to you and ask you for some information, or we might ask to have you speak to media. We'll work with you so that your job is a little bit easier. We have tremendous employees, some very dedicated and seasoned employees that have worked in the broadcast industry and really know both sides of the microphone and the camera. We're very blessed to have those folks working for us.
Well, DVS issues vehicle title and registration. We also issue driver's licenses and ID cards. We license motor vehicle dealers. And we also issue interstate motor carrier registrations and collect fuel tax from motor carriers. We also provide driver license and motor vehicle record information as we're able to, according to the state and federal laws. We are the face of state government because we come into contact with each Minnesota family on a yearly basis.
Public safety communications is critical in Minnesota in the dealing with any kind of a natural disaster, a high-speed chase, or a lockdown at a prison. And it's important that we have up-to-date emergency communications networks out in the field, and that we have it across the state so that there is no degradation in service. I've once been told that a criminal doesn't know county boundaries or state boundaries, so it's very important that we have that critical infrastructure throughout the state.
HSAM is the coordinating agency for state agency preparedness and local government preparedness, for local government coordination, for preparedness, response, recovery, and then mitigation efforts for disaster. I like to see HSEM as an umbrella because we have to really look out for the entire state and to make sure that whether you're in the northwest corner or the southeast corner, that you have the resources that you need, because all disasters are local. So when a local organization is beyond their capability, then you ask for the state resources.
Fiscal and Administrative Services provides financial support to the divisions within the Department of Public Safety. Everything we do in the agency, money runs through everything we do in the agency. There is a part of that that anywhere from the start of the budgeting process all the way through making a payment to a vendor.
Highly trained, motivated workforce is a productive workforce. We need to put the right person in the right place at the right time. And that's what we do here at Human Resources and Public Safety, is look for that right person to bring in. And then we do have somebody, we want to, a quality employee, we want to retain them and make sure that they're comfortable, they have a good working environment, and that they're able to do their job. We have a baby boomer generation that's retiring, and there's a lot of opportunities that are coming up in the near future.
Our office handles investigations into employee misconduct against the employees of the department. We respond to complaints from the citizens if they have concerns. We also ensure that we have a positive working environment within the department. We try to ensure that everybody is comfortable, that if somebody feels that they have not been provided with good service within by an employee of our agency, that this is a place that they can make that complaint.
Minute Services at the Department of Public Safety is an organization which serves all the information technology needs for the whole department, all the divisions here. And our technology also serves the citizens of the state of Minnesota, for example, our driver vehicle services system. So we have the service desk, which I'm standing in the middle of right now, and this group is here to make sure that all of your technology needs are up and working and available to you every day.
The mission of the Office of Justice Programs is to work in collaboration with communities to improve the functioning of the criminal and the juvenile justice system, and to support the healing of crime victims. We also support problem-solving courts, reentry for offenders coming out of prison to improve public safety, human trafficking initiatives, a really broad variety of initiatives that come from the community to address the problems of community safety.
Well, the Office of Traffic Safety exists to reduce fatalities and serious injuries on Minnesota roads. We do that by basically, we get most of our funding through the federal government, through the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, and we focus and funnel that through behavioral campaigns and education and enforcement campaigns throughout the state where we identify that there's problem areas on Minnesota roads.
The staff of the Fire Marshal Division and Office of Pipeline Safety really work towards preventing bad things from happening to citizens and visitors to Minnesota. And by bad things, we're talking primarily about fires and explosions and pipeline leaks. The most visual part of the Fire Marshal Division and Pipeline Safety is the investigations where they respond out to the scenes and do this work. That's what people know most about it. But really, there's a tremendously large section of people and work that's done to prevent those from happening. So, you know, all the work in public education and plan review and fire inspections and pipeline inspections kind of goes unheralded, but it's a great job and very rewarding.
We are a primary traffic safety enforcer in the state of Minnesota. We also provide assistance to local police agencies, federal police agencies, and other allied agencies. And another big component is we try to educate the public in hopes that we do not have to use enforcement to change their behaviors. I'd want new employees to DPS to be aware that although the troopers in the maroon uniform and the maroon cars and the hat were a very visible part of the state patrol, the most visible part, but we aren't just state patrol troopers. We're troopers and support staff and other employees that all are critical to us accomplishing our mission as part of the DPS mission.
Thank you for taking the time to watch this video and to learn more about the Department of Public Safety. The people of Minnesota are counting on you to work hard, be honest, and practice the golden rule as you carry forward the mission of this agency. Thank you.
Members, especially for new members to this committee, just so you know, it's probably a little complicated, and I'm not sure this is the best process, but some of the divisions within the Department of Public Safety don't come under the jurisdiction of our fiscal authority because of transportation funding. So it would be the Commissioner of the State Patrol, DVS, Capital Security, Department of Traffic Safety. Am I missing anything else? Anything that's transportation funding related from the federal and state government. So it's a little confusing, and I'm not sure it's the best process. And also the Senate does this a little bit differently. So when we have a conference committee, God knows what we'll do. But so anyway, that's just so. Would I miss anything that's not under our jurisdiction?
Mr. Chair?
DVS?
Yeah.
I didn't have a list
of them. I'll look quickly. I have an organizational chart in my book here.
All right.
I appreciate you saying that because we appreciate you watching the video. You can see how sort of unique and complex and diverse we are. And we realized as we viewed this before showing it to you that it wasn't covering all, it was covering more than what your jurisdiction is. But we hope that it was helpful to understand, you know, sort of it's a big picture within the Department of Public Safety. So thank you for allowing us the time. I will now at this time call on our first division director, Jackie Mines, with the Emergency Communications Networks Division to give her presentation. And I had, if Mr. Chair, if I could, and members, Bruce Gordon sitting to my left running the video is our communications director. You may see more of him, but I neglected to introduce him to you when he came up to the podium. But thank you.
Very good. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I would like to call your attention to some information in your packet. We have a division overview as well as a couple of colored maps of Minnesota that will give you some status on the major projects that are going on in our division. I would also like to thank each of you for taking the time to understand what our division does. Our mission statement is to fund and support interoperable public safety grade communication network solutions that permit public safety officials, emergency personnel, state and federal agencies to communicate easily with each other in a moment of crisis or to provide immediate responses to Minnesota citizens and any visitors to our state that request emergency assistance. We are funded from a 911 fee that is attached to every wireless device and telephone device, that can make a 911 call. Today, currently, that fee is set at 80 cents. We do have the option to raise that fee to 95 cents if we need to. However, for the past 3 years, we have attempted to keep our budget very tight so as not to raise that fee. There are two programs within my division that are associated with Mission Critical Public Safety Networks. The first is the statewide radio system, also known as ARMOR, and the second one is the 911 network. So when you dial 911 to report an emergency call, to report your emergency, your call is sent over a dedicated specialized network that only 911 traffic is on. It's designed specifically to handle those calls for minimum failure. And your call is sent to the nearest 911 public safety answering point or PSAP where a dispatcher will assist you. That portion of the network is called the 911 network. The dispatcher then radios the appropriate responders, such as law, fire, ambulance, and they in turn communicate with one another over the radio system, and that is the system we call ARMOR. Both of these mission-critical networks were very outdated and based upon 30 to 60-year-old technology, depending on which network you're talking about. We needed to upgrade the radio system due to some FCC narrowbanding requirements, and that required local government to upgrade their systems, as well as there were a number of towers out in the state, and they needed to be upgraded as well. And the 911 network really needs to accommodate wireless technologies such as text and video, text being important to meet the needs of and expectations of our younger generation, but more importantly, is the deaf and hard of hearing community has really come to rely on text messaging as a way to communicate amongst themselves and would appreciate the opportunity to communicate with public safety through text messaging. Until we upgrade that 911 system, we can't do that. So for an overview of our successes, we embarked upon updating the radio network in 2004 with the goal to have that completed December of 2012. The ARMOR system consists of towers, hardware, software to manage the traffic, and microwave links, trunk telephone lines to connect the towers. We built this tower infrastructure with the proceeds from the bond sale that's backed by the 911 fees. MnDOT owns and operates that system with oversight by a statewide radio board, and our division helps assist with operational standards and supporting the radio board as well as our local responders to use the system consistently the same way across the state. We have built this system to be to provide 95% mobile coverage county to county and throughout the whole state. We currently have 88% of the towers completed, with the 95% will be completed by the end of this first quarter, if not close to the end of this month. The remainder of the towers are in less populated areas where land has been kind of a challenge, but we're nearing resolution with U.S. Forestry Services and DNR to acquire that land. We've had a very successful partnership with local governments to find land as well. This project will come in under budget with about $15 million in reserve. 69 of the 87 counties are on the network today, with two more migrating this month. The rest are in various stages of exploring timeline for migration. They had initially made significant infrastructure upgrades prior to 2004, and they are just waiting for the end of that life cycle of that infrastructure to come onto the system. All of them are looking at participation plans with the system to see how to interface with it and how long it will take them to migrate. We have partnered with HSEM on many federal grants that have come out in the last 5 years, with millions of dollars being allocated to the locals to allow them to add infrastructure if they needed to or desired to, and to join the system, also used for training locals on this statewide system. This has been a particularly successful partnership between local government, Minute Services, the Department of Transportation, and Public Safety. Our second program, the 911 program, we began in 2008 to review the existing infrastructure and how we would migrate to a next-generation high-speed data network. We are in phase three of our project, the first phase being to establish some interoperability between two existing 911 providers, and the second stage to test out this new network, and the third stage to be deploying across the state. 24 of our 105 PSAPs have migrated to this network, and we make progress daily. We have about one public safety answering point per county, especially in Greater Minnesota, and we are partnering with Minute and BCA for a portion of the network so we can share our costs with BCA and become a little more efficient in our allocation of funds. This next generation network, along with the statewide radio system, has allowed for easier consolidation of PSAPs if they so desire. We have multiple PSAPs that have decided to consolidate, mostly in the metropolitan area, going city PSAPs, combining with county PSAPs. But we also have something relatively new called virtual consolidation with three PSAPs in western Minnesota, Stevens, Pope, and Grant County, where they're actually sharing infrastructure, they're sharing hardware and software, and they're helping each other out in terms of helping them with resources. So if, for example, they need a little help at one of the smaller counties to answer 911 calls on weekends, the larger counties can assist them. The third project or initiative that will be crossing our desk in the next few years is wireless broadband for public safety. This would be the ability to receive additional data with a 911 call and transfer that data to the ambulance or the fire truck or a law enforcement vehicle. So, for example, if you dialed 911 and you had a medical condition, you might want to opt into a medical database. And that medical data could be available for ambulance personnel and or the hospital to receive that. And that is a long-term goal. Today, quite a few law enforcement vehicles do have air cards, and they are able to access through a computer in their car additional information for law enforcement. But we'd like to eventually get to the point where we could allow some of that additional data to be available to fire and ambulance as well. Some of our challenges are keeping up with the consumer technology capable of interfacing with 911. So it's not just a voice call anymore. As I mentioned earlier, the younger generation really makes an assumption already that text messaging is available for 911. We have devices that are sold to elderly people that you can press a button and a call will go to the PSAP. And you have OnStar type services where crash data is available and could be made available to responding agencies. Making sure that that data will be kept private is going to be a second challenge for us in the upcoming years. Keeping up with consumer expectation years. Keeping up with consumer expectations. So a lot of times, like I said before, younger people just assume you can text 911. We will also be challenged with upgrading our statute governing 911, and we would also like to expand the existing statewide radio board structure so that it could support all emergency communications and become an emergency services board. We will also, not so much in the immediate future, but in future years, probably be dealing with a declining revenue stream in the fact that wireless growth has just about saturated the market. So, for example, if we have many people are getting rid of their wireline phones, and so that is reducing the revenue stream, and we're seeing those changes happening already. From an efficiency standpoint, I mentioned earlier that we're partnering with Minute, we're partnering with MnDOT, and we're partnering with BCA to reduce our costs, sharing network elements that are already paid for and out in the community to provide some of these services or a secondary path for some of these services. Combination of a statewide radio network and Next Generation really allows public safety answering points to work together in regions to share information and to run dispatch centers and to reduce some costs. The new network allows for better coverage and faster call setup times. It also really does allow for quicker and more accurate display of an emergency information to the dispatcher, and ultimately it will be available for all the responders. The trends that we'll see in the next upcoming few years is that there will probably be new feature functionality and capability available to dispatchers. There will be new and emergent dedicated network for wireless broadband that we will need to address. And we will have to deal with issues such as what kind of additional data should be made available and can be shared over this public safety network. And with that, that concludes my presentation, and I entertain any questions.
One question: when we go over your budget, maybe you can come back and tell us a little bit about the special revenue account, and now that ARMR's out almost fully developed in the 87 counties, if that account will be phased out, or legislative objectives you have for keeping it going. But we don't have to deal with that now. We'll deal with your budget. So, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Mines, I've got a couple different questions. Did I hear you say that the 911 PSAP, is that different than the PSAP centers, dispatching centers that for the patrol and the DNR and the MINDA?
Ms. Mines.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that the 911 dispatch centers across the state include the State Patrol dispatch centers, and the State Patrol dispatch centers support the DNR dispatch.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought I heard you say that you had tried to set up one PSAP 911 area per county. Is that correct?
Ms. Mines.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that has been something that's evolved over time at the discretion of the locals. So basically, in most counties in Minnesota, we do have one 911 dispatch center per county.
Representative Ward.
I find that interesting. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for allowing me to continue with some of the questions. Can you tell the committee where the, and I know that, Mr. Chair, already verbalized the difference between you know, this committee and say the Senate committee with the purview of the public safety umbrella, and State Patrol is not under this committee's jurisdiction. I only wish it was. Having said that, can you tell this committee on the what's happening with the consolidation of the PSAP units in the state? PSAP dispatching centers, please.
Ms. Fines.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the consolidation of the State Patrol is in full swing. I believe there are they have been consolidated down mostly to a center in Rochester as well as the State Roseville Center. There are still two PSAPs in Greater Minnesota that have yet to migrate. One of the things I'd like to bring about is that, you know, we, our division doesn't necessarily promote one way or the other consolidation or not. We've had a couple of studies done in the past few years that identify that consolidation should be at the discretion of the local government, whether or not they want to do it. In some cases, for example, Big Stone County decided to consolidate with Candy-Ohi County for dispatching services, and they did that because they have a declining population. It was difficult to find people to replace people who were going to retire, and it allowed them to have more resources for law enforcement. So we, again, try to make grant money available for consolidation purposes, but we leave that up to those jurisdictions to make those decisions. And you know, that would be under the purview of the State Patrol Center or, you know, division as to their decisions regarding that.
Mr. Chair, can I?
Representative Ward.
Thank you. Members, many of you know that the dispatching center consolidation with the PSAPs has been on my radar and other members' radar for a couple years now, going back to Chief Danaski and now Chief Daly. And we had 9 dispatching PSAP centers in the state of Minnesota. And and a few years ago, Chief Danaski, Colonel Danaski, suggested they go down to 3. And several of us in here, including some bipartisanship members, Representative Cornish, questioned that. And now Colonel Daly has said that, no, we shouldn't go down to 3. We should go down to 2. 2 dispatches. Now, understand that the PSAPs dispatch for the DNR, for the MnDOT, and the patrol. And I've been pretty vocal. I've been told that the horse has left the barn, but, you know, I'm concerned about the public safety, the safety of our law enforcement folks and our citizens. In the fact that the dispatching centers going down to 2 members are going to be dispatched out of Roseville and Rochester, and the 2 that are left, Ms. Mines, the 2 in Greater Minnesota that are left are which? Are which ones?
Ms. Mines, Commissioner,
Mr. Chair, committee members, the 2 left are Brainerd and Virginia.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Representative Ward.
So that means that when we're fully consolidated, thank you, Mr. Chair. That means when we're fully consolidated, we're going to be dispatching for the 2/3 northern part of our state out of Roseville, and then one in Rochester. So when I call into the dispatching unit and say I need an officer at Eldie's Corner, Eldie's Corner isn't on a GPS map. It's not anything, but the dispatching folks in that area know where Eldie's Corner is. And it really is concerning to me, members, that we are doing this, and I know this isn't under the jurisdiction, and thank you for the flexibility, Mr. Chair, of being able to discuss this. And, Commissioner, we have had some very good meetings about this, along with the Governor, along with Chief Daly. And I still, members, am concerned about it, and I hope you are as well, especially if you are from an area in Minnesota that is north of the metro. I know some of you are. So I just want to make sure that, you know, members understand that, you know, the consolidation. And I understand, and here's another point that I want to bring out, is when we started asking questions about this, this was not done for financial gain. This was not done for, you know, for a financial reason, for effectiveness and efficiency. And members, I'll tell you this. I have heard from constituents, and I have heard from law enforcement in my area, and in the whole state of Minnesota, that there's been some glitches. And I understand as you go through a new process, there's going to be some glitches. I get that. I understand it. I am just only praying and hoping that in the long term, we don't have some disaster that in our own districts, somebody's life is at risk or lost or whatever. So I wanted to make members aware of that. And, Mr. Chair, thank you for the time that you allowed me to do that. And the horse has left the barn, but I'm not done trying to lasso the horse and get him back in the barn. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner, has the horse left the barn?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the PSAP consolidation within the Minnesota State Patrol has been a project that's been going on for several years. And we are set to have the consolidation project completed by May 1st of this year. So...
Okay, thank you. Representative Simonson had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is somewhat related to Representative Ward's point, but I think more under the umbrella of this committee. But my question is specific to this. We've made this transition out of this 800 megahertz system. At least I'm hoping we all have made this transition by now. And when I read this, and talk about this statewide interoperability program, and I consider the statewide effect and the improvement in communication that has happened as this migration to 800 megahertz means that I can go to virtually any jurisdiction statewide and have the very same communication capabilities, which I find to be a very good thing. But my question specifically is more about the 911 answering centers that do not fall under the state patrol, but more so that fall under the counties or the cities or the local jurisdictions. And my question is, has the DPS or your division ever had internal conversations about the concept of maybe moving these 911 answering centers under the umbrella of the DPS? So they're all under one agency, so to speak?
Who would like to answer that? Ms. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I know that we've had sort of peripheral, not necessarily real dedicated conversations about that. The infrastructures within our sort of the Minnesota State Patrol PSAP centers probably would not be able to handle the load at the present time. But certainly as time goes on, as we think about the future, as I mentioned that we'd be talking about 5 and 10 and 15 years from now, I think that we will be having to be forced to have those conversations as we talk about regionalization and sharing of resources around the state of Minnesota. In DPS, as Director Mines indicated, we have left ourselves out of the discussion about the local control and local decision-making about their dispatch services.
Representative Simonson.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair, if I may. I think my question was more geared towards using the existing systems that are in place and more so a matter of controlling the policy and the operation of the centers. Because, quite frankly, and this kind of speaks to Representative Ward's point, I've lived through one of these consolidations of regional centers, and the service, quite frankly, is not as good as it was. And he's right that we are going to see a problem. And my question is specific to if we had these regional 911 answering centers under one umbrella, under one administration, under one set of policies, it certainly seems like it might make an improvement.
Ms. Mines.
Mr. Chair and representative members of the committee, you bring up a very good point and one that we talk about a lot. And I mentioned earlier in my presentation that we would really like to expand the role of the statewide radio board to be an emergency services board. One of the reasons that we bring that up is because today with the statewide radio board, we have built operational standards as to how to use the radio system. And the goal there is to provide consistency in how everybody handles emergencies. And it's, you know, while it does have its glitches and there are some people who don't, you know, maybe follow the training exactly as they should, there are majority of people who have really found that to be useful. And we get a lot of positive feedback for those operational standards. Now, today, we don't have operational standards per se in 911. The responsibility of local PSAPs is under the jurisdiction of the Sheriff's Office. There are training programs, and they, you know, do participate in those training programs quite consistently. But we would encourage if we were able to succeed in expanding the role of the radio board, what we would like to do is put a next-gen advisory committee under that board and start to develop operational standards for 911 that would be, created in conjunction with the sheriff's office and PSAP personnel and dispatchers that would allow us to be more consistent in our dispatching practices and processes throughout the state. And I believe everyone believes that that is really the thing we ought to do next. And we're very focused on wanting to help address some of those issues.
Representative Cornish, and then we're going to have to adjourn because we're done with our committee time.
Well, Mr. Chair, we're going to have these folks back, right?
Oh, yes.
Could I just leave three questions to bring back information
Absolutely.
Rather than answer now?
Yeah, absolutely. Representative Cornish.
Commissioner Doman, you know that my friend Representative Pamer and I are very interested in gun violence, and though we approach it from different ways, one of the problems is some of your agencies not getting the information to the National Center. If when you come back, if you could give us information and why this information, you know, if someone in law enforcement accused you folks of dropping the ball, let us know if that's an unfair label or what information you aren't getting that you are supposed to be getting to the information center about from mental health and this and that, going through your different agencies' information. If you could just bring back that information. The other one is license plate readers. There are a lot of things about that. I'd like to hear from DVS on what plan they have on license plate readers, and I'm really worried about, personally, I'd just assume that information be dumped if there's no hit or stolen. And then familial DNA, the BCA basically never got back to me for the last year. They promised that they were going to do some testing, some rulemaking, and they were going to answer me and get back with what their study showed about familial DNA. I haven't heard a word from them for a year, and I'm just wondering what the problem was there, the lab.
So, Commissioner, you'll make that information available. We'll try to give you a new schedule. We'd like you to come back and continue the overview, maybe next Thursday. But we'll get back to you. So, members, Commissioner,
Mr. Chair, could I ask one clarifying question? Of Representative Cornish, your first question regarding the information flow for background checks, are you talking in particular about the NICS system?
Yes.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, getting the information from Minnesota to the national information center, we're accused of not getting there, along with some other states that should show up in a check and isn't.
Mr. Chair, members, we'll make sure that we answer all of
those
questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. I apologize also to the other divisions within your department that we didn't get to them, but that's the way it goes here sometimes. Members, you have a survey here. If you could complete it bring it back here or get it to the committee administrator, Taken Holtz, by next Wednesday, we'll then figure out who wants to go on tours and how we might be able to organize that. So, with that, thank you, members. Thank you, Commissioner. This committee's adjourned.